It's a lot better.
Yeah, we're just all two houses.
For 9 months.
No, if you say no, yeah.
We've done that. We've been twice.
Yeah. Really? That happened in Ward 1.
In a while.
Yeah. Been there, done that.
Is that your seat?
No, no. Bob Allen got on. They wanted,
Mayor
Burt. Yeah, it was something with Mayor Burt.
That's the one that you eventually won, right? You
no, I went against, I took George's seat.
That's right.
Carlos Peter. But I mean, it was like, but they called the bluff or something. They called Val's bluff
or
something.
Yeah.
Okay. So she took okay.
Having 6 o'clock, we will call the Public Works Committee of Tuesday, January 17th to order. We have Alderman Milshewski, Alderman Cope, and myself present, as well as staff and guests. We will start with citizens' comments. So if anybody does have comments that they would like to address the committee with, we'll take that now. If you can give us your name and address, and then ability to speak. Would anybody like to address us?
Well, I will. I spoke last time. Don Hirsch, 649 White Oak Way, Yorkville. Situation hasn't gotten any better, at least for our subdivision. They still come through. We had one, as someone spoke here earlier, that snuck through the other night that didn't really honk his horn. But then we get the ones that try and make sure that everybody in River's Edge and our subdivision and Morgan and the streets down there know that they're there. And I guess since the upgrade of the tracks and the crossings this past fall, it's really gotten a lot worse. Prior to that, our granddaughter could take a nap and she wouldn't even know they were going through. Since then, I mean, it's gotten so bad, and I think I mentioned this last time, is that we take her back home up between here and Bristol to take her nap in the afternoon because she can't sleep through those train noises. So, and there's a lot more people that signed petitions and called and sent emails and are bothered by this than actually showed up tonight. But just wanted to let you know that we're still concerned and would be very grateful if you went ahead at least with the phase one research on the project. And even though it, well, I guess it does have the same importance of doing a study for a stop sign for the neighborhood. So I guess that's all the comments I have.
Thank you, Mr. Hirsch.
Yes.
Anybody else?
Is there... Don Peterson, River Birch Drive. The other Don Peterson. Is there any update of any kind so we can get some feel where the investigation is at this point?
We'll be discussing it a little later in the agenda. We should get through some items pretty quickly, and then we'll have some discussion on it and we have some additional information from staff.
Thank you.
Anyone else?
Yes. Carol Hirsch, White Oak Way. I'd just like to say that I talked to many of our neighbors. I passed the petition around and got all sorts of ideas. And one of our neighbors that has three young children has a concern that when there are festivals down at the Riverfront Park, those trains are flying by there. And that's a concern for her because of the festivals, the number of children, and the trains. By now, I realize that we can't stop the trains going by, but perhaps we can take that into consideration. I think that all goes along with development of the downtown area.
Thank you. Anyone else? Okay. Hearing no other comments, we will continue in on our agenda. Next item is our minutes for correction from December 20th, 2016. Any comments or corrections on those? If not, we will take them, we'll have them approved as presented. Continuing on, new business, Public Works 2017-01, snow operations report. Eric?
Simple, straightforward report here, just what we did since the last meeting. And as luck would have it, the day I actually turned this in, we went out that night.
So that'll be next. I see, I didn't even fill in the date here. I forgot it. But I believe it was last Tuesday.
And all equipment is functional, operating as expected, no hiccups.
When it wants to. When it wants to. We still work on just as many as are, you know, they come back in with breakdowns, but that's to be expected. Snow plowing and salting are rough on vehicles.
Absolutely. I did have one question on the brine.
Yes.
The other day I was coming down countryside, I ended up behind one of the plows.
Sure.
Salt truck, no plow.
Right.
He was spraying. It did take a while for me to recognize. I assumed he was spraying from the roads. I could see the marks on there, but mm-hmm. I could not see the spray until close. We don't have a sign on the back that says liquid salt. Is that a consideration we would maybe
do? We can, and a lot of times it won't be just, it'll just be, please stay back 100 feet,
something
please stay back 50 feet.
Yeah.
We can look into getting signs like that.
I think it was more prevalent because it was one of the new trucks. It was the stainless steel truck.
Yep.
And so that kind of blends a little bit, color.
Yep.
Maybe something to think about that.
Yes, thank you very much.
Jackie.
How is that brain working?
Good. We are actually getting it a lot closer to where we want to be for the pre-wet system. We still have a little bit of work to do for the anti-icing system. Which what we're going to do is actually put double the size pumps on when we do the anti-icing, so it spreads more.
And that's
brine.
When you do pre-storm.
That yes, that's what you what Chris
that's
saw
like we
was the anti-icing
yeah. when it rained.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Any other questions or comments on the report? Thank you. That's very informational for us. Continuing on, 2017-02, the Water Department report for October through December.
This is just to kind of get us back on that quarterly schedule. So now the next time you'll see it'll probably be March or April. It'll probably be April with January, February, and March on there. Not much to talk about here. A few main breaks, but that's to be expected.
Okay.
Everything else is pretty much normal.
Nothing seemed to be out of order there.
No.
Any questions or comments? That's for informational as well.
No, that actually gets passed.
That one we do pass. The last one we just did it all as annual.
Correct.
That's right.
Correct. But these have to, EPA requires us, the city council, to pass.
So with that, consent without objection. Okay. We will put that on, and that is
221, I believe.
First. On 2017-03, stagecoach crossing acceptance of public improvements.
All right, there's the detailed memo in your packet along with a series of exhibits. If you recall, the city entered into an agreement with Midwest Bank to complete the improvements at stagecoach crossing. The bank agreed to pay for that work. That work has since been completed. All the punch list items are taken care of and have been addressed. Therefore, the bank is asking for acceptance of those public improvements. So we are recommending acceptance. In this case, it's the water main, sanitary sewer, and a small amount of sidewalk. Typically with acceptance, we hold on to a maintenance guarantee in the amount of 10% of the original for a period of 1 year. In this case, we're recommending consideration of release of that. The improvements have been essentially in the ground for 10-plus years. We don't anticipate anything crazy happening where we'd have to draw on anything like that. So that's something just a little bit out of the norm. Otherwise, be happy to answer any questions.
And this, we're releasing everything that does not have to do with building permits. So anything that would be related to the actual building themselves will still be held. But
correct.
Anything in the ground, we're releasing.
That's correct.
It's just water and sewer, correct? Storm is private. Streets are
correct.
Private.
Correct.
Parking lots are private. Yes.
So we don't plow that street currently
correct.
At all,
right.
And so we won't either as we go
no,
forward.
No pothole patching, plowing.
Okay.
Any questions or comments? Good bit of housekeeping here. Without objection, we'll place this on consent for the 21st as well.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, continuing on. 2017-04, Bristol Bay Unit 3 acceptance of public improvements.
All right, the developer, Pulte, completed quite a bit of work in the development last year, last construction season. They have completed all punch list items related to the project, and they have requested that the city accept the public improvements, and we are recommending that as well. In this case, it would involve water main center, sewer, some storm sewer. There are some streets that are being accepted, although the majority of the area consists of private streets. Somewhat detailed on the exhibit that's attached. There's some street lighting and some parkway trees. Along with this, there would be a recommendation to hold on to a 10% maintenance guarantee. The current value of the bonds exceeds that, so there would also be a reduction, which is noted in the memo associated with the request. And again, be happy to answer any questions anybody has.
Any questions or comments? All right. Without objection, we'll place that on the consent for the 21st. All right. Is there anything else? 2017-05, the bond letter of credit reduction summary.
Yes, this is just provided for informational purposes, and you know, again, if there's any questions, we can address them.
Informational. Any questions? Okay. Continuing. 2017-06, capital improvements project update.
You have seen this on a quarterly basis here recently, and this is just the quarterly update. So maybe just to highlight just a couple projects, and if there's any other questions, I'd be certainly available to answer those. The Countryside project, as you know, we completed the water main installation and the binder course. We would anticipate the completion of that project to start probably later April, but majority of the work in May. In the early part of June, the contract completion date is the end of June, so all signs are pointing toward that being done by then. The Wrigley project, probably seen a little bit of work here and there about around the Wrigley site. We've had a little bit of delay due to some ComEd issues as far as powering up the lights and what have you, so we're working through that. Then there's been some other delays in some of the lighting as far as it being delivered and what have you. But all signs, again, are pointing to that being completed soon, just a matter of working out these final kinks.
Do you think that'll be next few weeks?
Yes, I'd say 2 to 4 weeks, 4 weeks max, I would say.
Okay.
On some of the planning and design projects, the Kennedy Road project, the last hurdle has been getting approval from the ICC. The full commission had a meeting last week. That project was approved at the commission. The order was received a little bit earlier today. There is an agreement that's necessary between the railroad and the city. So once the order was received, which was received today, now we can complete the agreement. So we should see that hopefully at our February series of meetings. And that's our last hurdle to get on to the IDOT letting. So definitely looks like we're not going to hit the March letting, but probably the April letting for that project. The other projects are essentially all in motion at various stages of final design. And we have noted our target lettings, which several of them are coming up.
Very good. Any questions or comments on any of the projects? Any projects not listed? All right. Was informational. Continuing on, 2017-07, the MFT resolution for 2017 Road to Better Roads program.
Okay, one of those projects listed in the memo we just rolled through is the 2017 Road to Better Roads project. Last several years, we've been using a couple different funding sources, MFT funds and then local city funds. Next year's project, or the 2017 project, is no different. The proposed budget is $300,000 utilizing MFT funds. And you've seen this annually, but typically we do have to pass a resolution in order to appropriate that amount before we submit the project to IDOT for review. So that's this process. That's kind of where we're at. We're ready to submit to IDOT and have them review and get the project on the letting.
Any questions? We've prior spoke about what the scope bid is included within the $300,000, so It's good to move forward. With that, no objection, we'll place it on consent for the 21st. Continuing on. 2017-08 Downtown Sidewalk and Rail Replacement RFP.
So I put together, with Eric's help, an RFP for doing fencing, or replacing the fencing right along by the law office as well as the sidewalk there. And then there's some sidewalk in front of, on West Van Emmen. I know we had originally talked about a railing, but after measuring the depth, it's not required from the drop-off to the yard, so we decided to take that portion out of it. So is there any questions?
Yep. On the west side, is that in front of Mrs. Groner's house?
It is.
So she'll get her new sidewalk, but there's not going to be a railing.
No railing.
And that's due to the slope and drop do not require a railing in that location.
Correct. We checked with Pete Rados. And at 3 foot from the sidewalk, in order to require that railing, it needs to be a 30-inch drop. And there is, none of them were even close. I think 22 was the closest.
Why were we putting it there in the first place? Was it a request from her, or just we thought it needed it?
I was under the impression that it needed it at 18 inches, okay. And I was mistaken.
Okay. So when she calls, they can tell her.
Yeah,
no railing,
absolutely.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And she was not too happy with the bushes being there. She liked the bushes there, so maybe we can make a compromise and put the row of hedge back.
The bushes and...
She had the row of hedges that were right along that sidewalk. You never used to be able to see the sea in her yard.
Okay.
And then we pulled them out. We did not. Her son did, and she did not like that too much.
Oh.
So, instead of a railing, the bushes were very nice there, and that made a nice railing and fence.
So, we consider...
Not arches. Proposing at all in this, but as a separate...
As a separate thing, that we would put on the bushes.
We've tried to accommodate her with the parking lot landscaping, too, so that wasn't required, but it's something we recognized as reasonable to put in, so it's a couple $100.
Yep. So
have you talked to her? Is she amenable to...
I did not talk to Janet about that. She is happy that the sidewalk is going in.
Yeah, she wants the sidewalk.
So
and that's fix her part, something with the parking's off there, too, in her mailbox.
It needed to be striped. Yeah, I believe
that was done.
Concerns about people parking in front of it, so it was striped as a no parking zone.
Yes.
Yep, it's all done.
Yes. Regarding the fence itself, the specification is very general. I assume our intent is to do a picket-style flat-top rail.
It's very general, but the specs are such as just like almost like the fencing that's on the wall that everybody doesn't like.
Right, that would be the assumption.
Is it going to be straight? It's like going to go like this.
It's going to go up a hill and then straight.
I mean, the assumption would be that, yes, it's a flat top on the rail.
It's just a nothing fancy fence.
In front of
two rails, three rails.
No, it has to be slants every 4 inches.
No. Horizontal rails.
Top and bottom.
This is where I'm looking at it. The specification is very, very general.
Right.
And yes, it's powder-coated galvanized steel.
There should
height
be
is dictated by the building code, which should be
the link in there. That's
36 or 40.
Very detailed.
Two. Right, and once you get in there, that is, the spacing is very well dictated by the EIBC.
Right.
But in terms of the design that we want, just leaving this open-ended for proposals?
To a point, yes.
So that's somewhat of my concern, is we have not dictated, do we want 1-inch thickets, 3/4, 2-inch top?
And I think what we'll do at the meeting, at any meeting or tell the vendors, there's only going to be probably a handful of people that bid on this kind of railing. It's very easy to say, look, we see what's out front. We would like something similar to that in a black powder coat.
Okay.
You know, we don't need a $200 a foot ornamental fence. We need something that's going to be strong and sturdy and withstand the elements.
Right. And obviously this is not a large. It's only 74 feet, so it's not going
to
garner a lot of people. But as I look at it, and I figure the local guys will try to bid on this one, but in terms of what they're bidding on without a pre-contact meeting.
We did leave it a little open, just we didn't want to get so specific that we pigeonholed ourselves. We just wanted to leave it open as to if you can't fit it within the spec so the 4-inch sphere does not go past through there, we'd like the top and bottom rail and make it galvanized and powder-coated.
How are you going to compare apples to apples without having a specific standard spec in terms of sizes on it?
I think
most contractors, when they see that building code spec, it's a basic fence. We didn't spec anything up from that, except for powder coating and galvanizing.
Basic fence, but it doesn't specify the picket size, the rail size, post size.
And it's probably all going to, they'll probably call and say, do you want inch and a half?
Inch and a half or 3/4 on pickets, rails.
Exactly. And when that happens, we'll say, look, we'll call everybody that picked up plans.
Okay. I just want to make sure that we're being consistent.
We're not going to have one that's got this beautiful 4-inch, fully detailed, filleted, gusseted, riveted, everything fence, and then and say it's apples to apples. Okay. We'll take that into consideration. We want to give them a little leeway, too, on the build. That also gives us better price.
True. It does. I just want to make sure that what we're going to compare
will
be equitable to all bidders.
It'll be okay. Northern Contracting, probably O'Malley's, and maybe Kendall County Fence. Those will probably be the three that'll bid on it.
Okay.
And maybe a couple others, but both of those will use either O'Malley's or Northern Contracting for the fence itself.
Okay.
Because it's all custom.
I get it. I'm not that keen on having it that open-ended.
Sure.
If the committee
Understood.
Is fine with it, I'll go with it. I'm not going
to... We could address that when it comes to
our people. When it comes back.
Oh, absolutely.
But this is where there's some variety that could be brought in, and that's where Eric is managing and dealing with them. It just takes more coordination.
I'm just managing the questions. The coach is going to deal with contractors.
There you go. Delegate. Okay.
How tall? Am I missing how tall it
42.
Is over there?
It's not specified, but if you go through the link to the IBC,
it's 42. Okay.
Their criteria on if it's so much of a drop, it could be as low as
36,
but the conditions, you have to read through it to figure out what height.
Because there's 42. Different heights. There's somewhere it could be 36, and then it could be 42, but I'll make it 42.
I'll make it 42 across so you don't get what
happened.
They will.
They'll all make it 42.
So we get our...
But you see, it just becomes so hard to specify. For the first 4 foot, it could be 30. No, let's just follow the code.
Put a level on it.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Any other questions or comments? Or we'll take this one to consent without objection for the 21st. Okay. 2017-09 Riverfront Park testing results. This is one I had added on so we could kind of get a quick discussion about what we're planning to move forward with and why based on the testing results that have already come back.
Sure.
Obviously your memo is in here. Can you give us a little background on the rationale of the additional testing based on what we found in the results that we have? Already.
Yeah, I think it was we talked about a couple months ago. Generally, the east side of the playground footprint was more contaminated than the west side. And while we excavated the area that we found the contamination and removed it, we had some thoughts that there's probably additional contamination to the east of the existing footprint. Based on the types of contamination found and the levels, the environmental engineer didn't recommend that we put a playground in that location unless we remove the soil, and didn't think that it would be appropriate for us to encapsulate that area without further remediation. So we removed the soil so that way there's not an issue for the area that we have tested, and then the thought was, well, we need to figure out the geographic boundaries of the existing contamination. So we picked three spots, one to the east of the playground, one to the north of the playground, and then clear across the park on the west side in the parking lot in front of Ginger and Soil. And it's Ginger and Soul. And so the thought is that if for some reason both of the other two testing sites come back with contamination, and depending on the level, that there could be a scenario where you'd say, enough with this area over here, we're going to do what we need to do to treat it, but maybe it turns into a passive area, or it turns into a parking lot, not a playground, and let's move the playground somewhere else. So as far as we know, there shouldn't be any contamination on the west side of the park, and so that was kind of just our second choice. So and so that was the idea, is just trying to get an idea of the geographic limits of contamination, that way we're making sure we've got an educated decision on park planning in the future. And so I think he's got the testing crew lined up for tomorrow. So that everybody's okay with that decision. You know, hopefully in a few weeks we'll have a better idea of whether we're going to have to move the playground and or do some additional remediation down there.
So as it stands right now, our plan is not to move the playground if we don't have to.
Correct.
We would be considering remediation of the soils, which would be hauling away, physically removing the soil, hauling away to a special dump facility, and then filling it back in. If that is cost prohibitive, then we would have options for alternative locations. That's correct?
Yeah, that's fair.
So and then even if we are able to remediate this site, we would then have the ability to know what contaminants are elsewhere, if any, for future planning. As we know that a few of these locations are part of our improvements that we have done. So, any questions or comments on procedure?
Can the footprint of the park, if this doesn't work out, go back to where the park used to be? Because I'm assuming that, well, I'm making the assumption that
it could. I think from a long-term park planning perspective, Tim and Scott felt that it would be better to push the playground further west. Mm-hmm. That way the center of the park could still be used for, like, mass attendance mm-hmm. or concert mm-hmm. events. But that's all, you know, depending on what they turn up, and then mm-hmm. feedback from the park board. I'm sure
and we don't really know if that soil's okay.
Exactly. We think that it's fine because as you went further west on the playground footprint, mm-hmm. it was fine. But we'll see.
If we received a better idea of the mitigation for the playground area as it is right now,
The hallway cost, I believe it was $1,400 for the actual disposal of the dirt. I'll go back and check, but it was less than a few thousand.
Okay.
So certainly under what I had feared could potentially occur for making sure that the site is 100% okay.
And that's based on what the soil results came back in as to how much would have to be taken out of there.
Yeah.
So the testing results, then, did we go deeper and we found that there was no contamination deeper? Because you're sitting hauling away the top part, right?
Yeah, and I don't remember that far in depth on the technical details. And I can go back and ask the environmental engineer tomorrow. But he basically made the recommendation as to how much to excavate based on the results. So I don't know if he like read the results and then decided to test deeper, or if he said no, you know, the mm-hmm. contamination is only so deep, and then he excavated a certain portion. So that I don't know off the top of my head.
Planning purposes to expend the money on the additional study does kind of help us, covers us in case we do have any other issues out there on the playground or the park itself. But it gives us an idea. My big concern was how much is it going to cost to remediate the park, the playground area specifically. We had some very large numbers that were potential unfunded that we would have to deal with, so the cost is not as bad as
I always thought that was going to be if the whole thing was contaminated.
Well, if the whole park, I mean, if we like test and then we find out the geographic area is more and we decide to expand the testing, I mean, to do the entire like park area, that's where we threw out, you know, could be $1 million easily.
Okay.
But, you know, we're hopeful that just with the amount of construction that was done down there with the state, and they, you know, it's right there. What they observed, construction workers, you know, I'm surprised that this didn't come up, you know, sooner. So, or come up earlier when the state was down there. So I can't imagine that it's going to be widespread. I'm hoping that it's only going to be that area there. We're going to test it, figure out the boundaries, remediate it, excavate it, and then move on with the park planning initiative. So I don't know if we really talked about it, but we notified the IDNR and the IEPA of the issue, and the IDNR, who's got the grant down there, basically told us, well, you've got to take care of that and let us know how you took care of that before we expend further funds. So Tim's plan basically to accelerate Riverfront Park and get that done this year, or last year, obviously went out the window with this discovery. And so we're pivoting over to Bristol Bay Park to get that done. And then, depending on what comes up with the testing, we'll move forward with Riverfront after that.
Okay. And with the playground, the walls that have been built to date, those are going to be undisturbed, or will those have to be removed for the remediation?
To be determined. So okay. It depends on what the testing results show up. And obviously, I mean, that's a bit of a sunk cost, and while we prefer not to waste that effort, it may be necessary, depending on what the test results come back.
And I assume with those, the caps and potentially all of it are glued in place?
That I don't know. I didn't get Eric, into the details, you know, how that salvageability.
I think the caps obviously are glued on after that.
The lower rows, you're not certain if they were glued in
I don't
place.
Believe they were.
Okay.
Because it's so low.
If
so
they are glued.
Salvage value.
Okay, so that's my concern is obviously labor for dismantling it, storing it. But
that's the big cost.
Yes.
It's the labor
and then if there are any pieces that, you know, the glue can become problematic when you disassemble them. So
maybe because it's newer, it won't be as...
Oh, it'll be...
Okay. We're stuck.
It's stuck. Okay. Those are not going to be...
That stuff is very strong.
It's intended to keep them in place. Okay. So, of course, additional cost there as well. So, unexpected costs as we go. So, all right. This was for an informational piece for us. Staff is going to move forward with that testing. And you said they're ready to go tomorrow?
Yeah. Because of the weather, it's actually worked to our advantage. So we took a little while to actually make the decision to do it, and weather is held out for us.
Okay. Any other questions or comments on that? Then we will continue on. Old business 2016-84, well number 3, abandonment. Do you plan your proposal?
All right. At the December Public Works Committee meeting, we had some detailed discussion on the abandonment of a well number 3 and staff's recommendation. At that time, there was some discussion to request a formal proposal from Lane. We went ahead and did that after the meeting, and they've supplied the document that's in your packet. We've summarized it in a cover memo. So basically, the proposal from Lane is to abandon the well at a cost of $37,450. They also note pump and motor decommissioning costs. However, they have offered to basically wipe out that cost if the city turns over the pump and motor to them, because they would have use for that. They also have assigned a salvage value for some of the miscellaneous equipment, cable and piping and what have you, where they would provide an additional credit of $1,894. Staff is recommending that we give Lane the ownership of the pump and motor, as we have no need for that at the city, and also that they take the miscellaneous equipment, and we take them up on the salvage value of that. So the net recommendation or dollars of the cost to complete the abandonment is $35,556.
So with that, it's good that we would give them back the pump and motor for decommissioning. That way we don't have to handle any of the paperwork for disposal.
Or mercury.
Mercury, exactly. So as they have to
right.
do that. And would that be something that is separate from the proposal, or will that be included with, and they will...
I believe it's all included.
All included. So net to us would be $35,000 to decommission, as compared to a few $100,000 to rehabilitate.
Correct.
Now that's just the well. That's not the building.
Right. The building is something.
Restoration.
I was going to ask that next.
Later,
yes.
If we so choose to.
Once Lane's out of there, then we can create the scope for what we want to do with the building.
And obviously, the building looks better now that it's been painted with the Lily rehab. We don't have to do anything at the moment for it. We could leave it there and use it as storage or whatever and make a decision at a later date. So we can take that as it comes. So,
would there always be a spot, though, where the well was at?
Nope.
And if you took the building down and you don't have to leave a little...
Nope, it'd be
once
gone.
It's kept and filled,
okay.
Somebody could actually build something there, put a foundation.
That's yeah, what I didn't
and
know.
It was a massive amount of bentonite that they used. I can't even remember how many. That's like 40,000 pounds of bentonite that they're going to put down the well. Mm-hmm. And it expands and seals in place.
Okay.
Yeah.
So.
48,000. That's close.
So any questions or comments on that? I think this is good for us to move forward with this abandonment. With that, without objection, we'll place that on consent for the 21st.
Thank you.
Moving on. Public Works 2014-74 Railroad Quiet Zones.
A couple different memos in your packet. One, I did include everything that I could find in the email archiver. I did complete another search, I think it was Friday afternoon, and it looked like after I picked through it that there was a lot of overlap with some search terms that I had already used that were in the packet. So I'm not sure that there's a whole lot extra that I would have found and pulled from. So I think what you've got in the packet is, you know, the majority of it. And then Aaron's got a nice memo in there with what Sugar Grove, Kane County, and Elburn had done on the UP line up in Elburn and then on the BNSF line down in Sugar Grove. And, you know, they're right around $200,000, which is kind of the plug number I think we'd used in the past couple budget memos. And we haven't really found anybody yet that's done the railroad closure and gotten grant funds yet, so that's something we're still trying to research to try to bring to everybody. Just, you know, for an example of, you know, what kind of funding level you can expect with that type of a project. So if anybody has any questions on the new materials, happy to answer them. And I think we probably had enough of the engineering agreements at the last meeting as far as what they entail. But if anybody has questions about that, I can answer that.
So with the new information, it's rather consistent that it was approximately $200,000 for a crossing that they had done. So that's
$3 or $4 million,
the exhibit that shows where those crossings were done, you know, Sugar Grove, Big Rock, the Plano's, they're individual crossings at $200,000. When we look at what our scope is, we're looking at 16 crossings throughout the city. That's a big number to have to plug in there. Jackie?
Can I just clarify, is it $200,000 per crossing?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, because it doesn't, where I'm reading, it doesn't say that.
Yeah, each of the three projects, I think, was only one crossing in each one of them.
Right.
Gotcha.
Yeah, so if you go to the exhibit, the map shows
reading
where
those here, just
and I know that. EEI has done a few of these, and I don't know if they've done any multi-crossing ones for any other town.
City of Aurora, we did Quiet Zone, and there was a closure there.
Okay. What was the level of funding, do you know?
I do not know that. Okay.
I can't imagine there would be scales of economy on a project like this either, unfortunately. Due to every crossing being different, it's not like you're going out and putting the same thing up at every single place. That doesn't seem to have a value. Jackie?
My note is that, my thought, that Elburn, you're looking at Union Pacific Railway, which is really active, and so is the Burlington Northern. Do we have a way, or is there a way to find out how many go through these crossings? Like, how many go through Elburn? Like, how many trains a day? Versus, so Elburn, was a Sugar Grove, and then versus ours. Did we get those, or can we get those numbers?
Mm-hmm. With the Elburn, does that include the commuter train as well?
No.
No, okay. I didn't think that was subject to that one. I thought they were separate lines.
Oh, no, it's the same line. It just doesn't go through
the
intersection.
It
stops east of
the commuter line stops east of where the mm-hmm. crossing the flight zone is. Okay.
Because it's like the end of the commuter line, is correct?
Mm-hmm.
Does Amtrak go through there too? And the one for Sugar Grove, does Amtrak go through there on that line?
No.
Okay. So it's just our light in Plano.
Okay. I did go through those emails, which was kind of daunting. And one thing I did notice is there were a lot of repetitive emails because of the nature of an email. Every time you add a response or comment, I assume that the system is picking each one of those up as a separate email, because I finally realized that I was reading the same one, 5, 6, 7, 8.
Yeah, I tried to
edit it down. It's just, there's so many of them, it's difficult.
So, I know in here there's a couple hundred, but do we have an idea of how many that really translates to in terms of emails? Because I was trying to gauge how many comments are there, how many different emails responses. I was looking, at least in the community, where we were going through the questions from the community, trying to get the feedback. You know, you go through question 19, there might be 200 responses, and two of them were related to the railroad. That's an easy one to say.
Yeah.
This question, how many responses, what's the percentage of them related to the railroad? I was kind of having a hard time gauging the railroad, the total emails that we've had.
Yeah, and I didn't count them, so several dozen, but I didn't know. I don't know if that's 36 or whether it's, you know, 100.
And I'm just trying to look at it, gauge it. I know we've had, you know, a few more emails as of late in a tight span, so obviously there's an issue. When you look at these go back quite a ways in terms of the history of...
2008.
Yeah, I mean, we're going back several years with the history of issues. You know, you get a spattering of issues here, a spattering of issues, and then, you know, in the timeline, it kind of goes quiet for a while.
Yep.
So, I'm trying to just put it all together as to what are the issues. I just know if it does have something to do with the improved railroad, if they're putting more trains through it, different engineers. I know some of the emails.
Yeah. My characterization of that time frame is that all the ones in 2008, 2009, 2010, those are all related to BNSF line and a lot of people moving into the Grand Reserve subdivision. And I know that the BNSF line, because there's a lot more trains on it, a lot more freight, I mean, they're more prone to variances, both in types of trains, length of trains, frequency. And then recently, I haven't taken any complaints on the BNSF line, and I don't think there's been any since that 2010 time frame. They've all shifted to be the Illinois Railway line, and they've seemed like they've picked up within the past year or two on, you know, multiple trains per day, whereas it used to be just one or two. So, and they don't have to notify us, like, of schedules. You know, we have a pretty good relationship with the railway now because the operations manager actually lives in town, but even he doesn't disclose, you know, exact operational plans to us.
So we really don't know exactly how many a day?
No.
Well, we can go out there and count them, but, I mean, nobody is, like, keeping track of it, and they don't have to give us that information if we ask.
But is there a way to find out for Elburn? I mean...
We can give you an average, and there's an average on their website as well. I'm just looking at BNSF average right now. It's by car type right now, so I'll have to do a quick calculation. But we can get an average.
I'd appreciate that. So then how many crossings? So we're looking at 200,000 a crossing. So if how many crossings are we talking about?
I would say keep in mind, those are almost 10 years old. Those particular improvements that were made, so I think we had estimated anywhere between 250 and 500,000. And each crossing is a little bit different. Mm-hmm. So until you perform some analysis and some calculations.
So how far would we go with this? I mean, if we look at this, are we looking all the way down to, say, Hoover? Is there a crossing in Hoover?
Yeah.
And then all the way in?
Correct.
I mean, actually, we go out farther than that. I don't know what other crossings we have past Hoover, though.
There's a county.
Is that all county?
But
yes.
Okay. Yeah, that's all county property now as you go out there because they have picked up all the property to Fox except for the Borneman property. That's what's the Boy Scouts in.
And then you're talking all the way then to the park.
I think we, in the past budget memos, we'd assume that it would be, I think, 12 crossings. And so then the idea of being obviously is that a lot of them in the downtown. You know, you've got five or six of them. You know, you've got redundancy there with multiple streets, and then it probably actually makes sense just from a traffic flow and resident peace of mind to close those. So that ups your score elsewhere, and then you're eligible for funding. We just don't know how much. Right.
Okay, and then if we do this line, then you're going to have to probably look at the one in Grand Reserve.
Yeah, it'd be our recommendation.
So we have to figure out, is that 11 crossings including there?
Well, it's
11
on the south. All right, I just did the math. It was 16 total.
16, thank you.
And so, but part of that discussion is if we're doing it, we have the four up north and we have the balance on the IR, do we close some of those? So, you know, it's not just a simple saying you take 4 million times 16.
Right. But
if
that's
you close
where we're
two or three,
now.
Right.
But there's a cost to close all of those.
Right. But then there's financial benefit to closing the crossings as well.
Well, we think that, right? We don't know for sure about that.
Yeah, we don't know the types of funding or the percentages. but that's what we've heard.
Would the first part of the study tell us that or not?
I would expect that it would give us some idea. I don't know that it's going to pin down availability or funding level or percentages, but I would hope that, you know, when we're talking about cost estimate and feasibility, that it would talk about those things.
Yes, our the one to the north, the Burlington Northern, much more straightforward. So we're planning on doing some initial calculations and investigation. The one, through town here, again, some initial calculations, and then looking into the funding opportunities. And to provide some feedback, you know, once we made that connection.
So out of the 11, what are you thinking you could close? Like all the ones downtown, like from the parking lots? There's two.
Well, you'd have East Alley, West Alley.
East Alley, yeah. So that takes you down to 9, which is not helping us a lot. What other,
there's 3 or 4 streets west.
Morgan, Adams, State, Main. Do you close any of them? Yeah. I mean, that's kind of the question. They're all residential areas.
That affects the people
right
that
now,
are there
right.
when you close their street.
You start creating one-way dead-end roads.
Essentially, you have that now in a way, though, because hydraulic, you can't only make a right only there. So you can't make a left. At hydraulic now, anyhow, from the west side. So most people probably do take Van Emmon to the light.
But if you close the alley, if you close East Alley, then you cut everybody off from
the
alley all the way over to Houston, assuming that people are not cutting through the private property there. And that's a very large block. It's not to say that it can't be done. It's not to say it's bad.
Well, that and the entrance to the south is steep.
Mm-hmm.
It's blind.
Right.
You know, by the law office.
Yeah, it's pretty bad.
Mm-hmm. So
I mean, it's even bad people going in there. You know,
right.
like they.
So now
like
you're going to have all
left,
traffic in
and
out. And
you get that
right.
car that's going to flip. I mean, I'm surprised nobody's.
Honestly, right now, most people
there.
Know that that's the one you go in.
Yeah, and you come out.
And then you come out the other
one. Yeah, so you're looking at closing that.
And so.
And then if somebody wants to develop there, then that limits them what they can cross.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that could affect them, too. So something to think about if you're talking about closing crossings. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of impact on that.
I mean, if we're talking $3 to $4 million of ultimate cost mm-hmm. to have to implement a full quiet zone throughout the city, that's quite a cost. I mean, that's far more than what we're doing for our Road to Better Roads program for roads. And I get the fact that this is something that will improve quality of life. I do understand that. I get that. If we didn't have train horns, everyone in the city would potentially benefit from that unless you're an actual lover of the horns. And that's something you do. I hear them where I'm at. I'm kind of straddled between the two. I know that they are both there. It's a challenge. Do I want to see what we can do and find out how much it is? Kind of. I mean, it's an expense. Mm-hmm. Can we actually afford the mitigation costs? You know, $3 or $4 million. If we have $3 or $4 million to put towards railroad quiet zones, our roads should be in a lot better condition than what they are today. That's kind of where I'm struggling with this.
Well, yeah, and if you put the money out on the study, it's done. How long is it going to last?
Right.
So you do the study and you find out it is $3 or $4 million.
If we can't afford to do the
work.
We
just kind of threw the money out. You know.
Right. How long would the study be valid for? If we just chose not to act and do anything, how long would this study be good?
Tim, I know there's a time limit on between the diagnostic meeting and then, you know, before everything needs to be complete. I don't know if it's a rule of thumb, but if situations change,
that's the big thing is that if conditions change, you're forced to redo your diagnostic meeting. As far as this first phase that we were proposing, we're not having an official diagnostic meeting. We're just doing some, you know, preliminary informal meetings, I guess. And then, you know, part of the analysis with the quiet zone risk index calculation is you assume an ADT. So, I mean, that would be a consideration is that traffic grew so much, you know, in 10, 20 years or whenever this would be revisited, then it might throw the calculations out of whack. So usually, you know, we we bump up our EDT just to kind of account for that and when the improvements might happen.
So conditions would be traffic count, like physical geography of the area, if there's a development nearby, maybe change like sight lines, accident history, right. Other things.
And so usually the railroads are the ones that are kind of persnickety, and if you're not implementing or doing your notice of intent within a year or two, they're going to say, well,
do it again.
We got to go back out and do our diagnostic meeting.
So if we were to do the study and we have, you know, in the next, say we do the study, we don't do it anything within the next 3 or 4 years, but in 5 years, 6 years, we have an industrial user that chooses to use a rail spur and is running 40, 50 trains, you know, cars through there. Is that the type of an impact that could cause us to have to reassess and go back through the study?
Correct. Well, I think, you know, it's kind of complicated because we're talking about two separate issues here. Yeah.
You know, but I'm just trying to get a basis of what could change, what could create us to have to expend additional cost to do the phase one part of the study. I mean, is that possible that things would change in the, you know, 3, 4, 5, 10 years that we'd have to redo the initial phase?
Yeah, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm probably pretty certain that we would have to redo the calculations if we were to wait 10 years. I mean, I think that's, you know, that's pretty much a given. Wouldn't you think? I mean, 10 years is a long time to wait for any...
If we're within 5 years. Kind of borderline.
Probably, yeah. Very much.
And
so
if we say we're within 5 years, if we project out our budget, our five-year budget that we have, that we've been working with, things don't look good for us financially in 5 years. I mean, we're okay, but we have some hardships, correct?
Yeah, you've got a declining general fund.
So, with that, I want to be optimistic about what we can do. Can we fix our roads? Can we provide the general required services we need to have? And can we improve quality of life? You know, we're trying to build a playground downtown. We're spending money on the playground to fix the problem so that we can have that playground reinstalled because we had to remove it years ago because it was not safe for the residents. So we want to do the things we can do to make our community better, but at what cost? So
just to address a couple of things, to address the festival issue, when we used to have Riverfront there, mm-hmm. and we used to volunteer, they would let us know when they were coming through, I do believe. And there was something
we would let them know that we were having a festival.
Or was it we would let them know we had a festival? So they're aware.
We put up that temporary orange fencing as well.
So that, to say that's a problem of the train going through.
And the drivers of the train slow.
Right.
So the people who have been here know, I just don't want to spend the money on this. I live on Houston's. I live right up from the train. I bought my house there 19 years ago with three little boys. Never asked even how often that train came in. I wanted that house. And I think you all bought your houses and you knew the train track was there.
Yes.
And it has increased. On the flip side, what if we do all this and Silica Sand, that's what they're shipping out of there, bus. And then we go back to the one or two a day. I can't, like you said, there's roads, there's things we have to do, and I think we're doing this for a limited amount of our residents, and I know it's a pain if you live right by it, but it's buyer beware. We all bought our houses there. I'm just as guilty as you are. I hear it. Went through after 12 o'clock last night. I'm used to it. It doesn't wake me up. I've been there for 19 years. So I'm just torn because, like I said, I bought my house there. I knew there were a train there. I knew there was a river there. And, you know, I don't know.
Gentlemen.
All right. I know we have a few people that want to make a comment. Since we have the public comment, I'll give one comment. I think there were three hands that I saw come up. But please make it brief, if you would. I appreciate that.
Yeah, I really appreciate acknowledging me. One of the things that amazes me, truthfully, is the difference in the horns depending on the train. In other words, we've seen, you know, in White Oak, and we've seen where at the same time with apparently the same thing in the middle of the night, the train goes through with no horns, And another time, they're on it, it seems like every 5 seconds. The guy's blowing the horns. Has anybody ever thought to ask, what are the criteria for using the horns? I mean, I'm hearing some huge numbers for, you know, what, and I don't really know what you're proposing to go after, but what are the rules? What do these guys have to do? If they have to do it, that's one thing. But it amazes me where a lot of times they'll go through and you don't hear a thing. You hear the train, but you don't hear any horns. So there must be some criteria that the federal government or somebody must have set down. And either they're not doing it sometimes or they're overdoing it sometimes. Maybe that'd be a way to look, at least the first step, to see if we could save some money. Because I'm amazed at the cost that you guys are talking about. And I'm sure you need to do that if you have to do it right. But it might be a very simple thing to see. Are they doing what they should be doing?
Thank you. We'll get your name for the record.
Ray Wolzer and White Oak Way.
And go ahead, Jeff.
Just to throw this out there, I'm not from a train family. My dad was a train buff, and I grew up in Cicero and Berwyn, so the trains went by all the time. My dad, for entertainment, would take us watch to the train yard and watch them, like, stand on the bridge and watch them mix, change out the boxcars. So something to keep in mind, because of what I was and I was talking about, I actually worked right by the Burlington Northern Railroad tracks, and something to keep in mind about the train, and it would be nice to know, you don't know this sounds terrible, if that engineer's had a bad experience. You don't know that. Has he hit something? Has he hit somebody? Has he hit a car? I mean, it's just something we all need to keep in mind, too. You're dealing with one person that's... And there are rules.
If we could, please.
You know, and I know where you're going. That's a good suggestion. Right. It really is. But sometimes, so maybe you have one that is more lax on it. But maybe that other guy, maybe he's had a bad experience and he's hit somebody or something.
Or maybe there's something, you know, yeah, that he's trying to warn, like an animal.
And, right. Or something he's trying to warn. You know, but, right. But it would be a but something we, thing I think on the flip side, we have to keep in mind, too, of the people on the, you know, I was just telling Bart when I worked in Berwyn, there was a couple that thought they were in a hurry and went around. Sure. And where I worked, the train and part of the car ended up right in front of where I worked. So, you know, they're horrendous things that happen, and sure, you have to realize, you know, maybe that's why he's more of a stickler on it. So it's just something we also have to keep in mind. We don't know what he's seeing or what he's doing as he's, you know, being the engineer of that train.
And I think, as Bart mentioned, we do have a good relationship with the railroad supervisor.
Or the operations manager.
When we do have issues, calls do go in, emails go in to this person about the issues. We know that some of the train engineers have been laxed in meeting the minimum standards of the railroad criteria for the horns. I mean, there is a minimum, and then they can go above and beyond that. And as Jackie said, there could be reasons for that. There could be someone close to the tracks. They could see headlights. We know that there are houses that are on each side of the tracks, very close. The engineers that go through this area, most of them know where the houses are. Some don't. So if you get a new engineer, could be reasons for it. So various issues.
Sure.
Take another one quick, if we could, quickly.
Okay. Carol Hirsch, wait up, please. I'm just wondering about, these trains come from Silica Sand, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Because I looked at Silica Sand's website and reading that they just bought like 350 acres down in LaSalle County for more sand, that this area provides the nation with the most sand. So rather than decreasing the number of trains, I would expect that the number of trains would increase over the years. Is that something that we can find out?
Well,
if they expect an increase?
We can ask. As Bart alluded to, they have no obligation to provide us with information. The railroads far supersede any authorities that we have, and they do not have to provide us basically with any information if they so choose.
And I don't know, would Silica Sand share that with us?
Part of that, right, part of it's their operation.
How, if you're going to expand, how are you going to ship it?
Well, I was going to say problem because the truck traffic going down to the river is eating up their roads.
And we know that railroad's been there for 100 plus years. Mm-hmm. And it has serviced other products at the time, but it is a business plan that this railroad has. They service one product only. And
obviously it's advantageous for them to ship that product, and we just happen to be a pass-through. We receive no benefits, but it shows that at least that industry is doing well.
What I'm not successful in my own mind tying together, forgive me for sitting, is why, to stop the horn from blowing, is all that expense per crossing required? Is it some sort of protective stuff that has to be installed?
And everything.
Brett or Eric, one of you wants to kind of go into a couple of scenarios of what it would take to...
Go ahead, Brett.
I'll probably defer to Tim.
That's why you bring the expert.
In order to be quiet zone eligible, each of the crossings within the quiet zone must have constant warning time and then gates. So while those facilities are present on the BNSF line, the Illinois RailNet line at most of the crossings does not have that equipment. So that's the majority of the expense to provide those facilities.
There's also sensors that are on track downways, too, right, from where the crossings are at?
Right, that's the constant.
That's a constant warning, yeah.
Okay.
Forgive me, our crossing at River Birch has ding-dong-ding-dongs in it. You know,
warning. The gates don't know gates.
No gates.
You need gates. That's what the expense is.
Yeah, gates and lights.
Okay.
And unfortunately,
usually, because there's traffic.
When you have to upgrade one of those, you typically are not just adding the gates to it. You're typically having to replace all the equipment, all the mechanics that go along with it to meet current standards. That's where you get caught in the expenses.
And I believe if there's a pedestrian crossing, you have to have a gate for that, too.
A gate for a pedestrian.
A little one to come down for, like, a sidewalk or something.
Mm-hmm.
Just one last thing. When we go to, let's say, Route 59, going down what street? 125th?
In Plainfield, there's no gate there.
There's no gate.
It's just a warning sign, and there's a median.
It says no train horn.
Correct.
Yeah, right. It's the same.
What's the median? So there are some crossings in the Chicagoland area that do not have them, but for the most part, when you go through the railroad process, they require you to put the gates in. So I'm not sure if that was a package among many others that they had applied for and done, but, I mean, that's been brought up by people in the past.
So there have been no exceptions for horn blowing unless, just so I'm clear in my own mind.
Oh, unless there's a quiet zone, I would say absolutely that's correct.
Yes.
Rules is rules.
Well, and you know, when I first moved here, FS was still open. And you didn't get, you know, like out by you wouldn't have heard this, but they would actually come in at night and they had a separate horn. And we got used to it that they were there to pick up or deliver. And they
would stop and back up.
And you'd hear it. And you'd
every time they went past the crossing.
Yeah, it was a whole, it wasn't a blast, but it was more of a toot. Yes, it was a quieter, but they would do that several nights a week.
Somehow I thought I understand.
Yeah.
So, question I had, maybe you can answer it then. Let's say you get somebody driving a train that he decides, okay, there's so many streets, I'm just going to stay on the horn from the edge of the park.
They do.
So it's constant for a couple
Depending
minutes.
Depending on how fast he's going.
Yeah, if you time it, it's
so
a few minutes.
He's really not following the little per intersection rule.
Well, but
that's a minimum.
Keep in mind, here's my understanding.
So the maximum is up to him.
My understanding is that the minimum has to do with distance traveled and speed. So if you were to have the horn blare for 100 feet at 30 miles an hour, it's a certain amount of time. If you were to blast the horn for 100 feet at 2 miles an hour, that's a consistent, constant horn for a significantly longer time. And that's my understanding as to the rationale is as you're approaching certain points, your horn goes for a certain amount of distance at that speed. So if you're going slower, your horn's going to be perceived as a longer horn.
Okay.
Now, we know that there are speed restrictions through certain areas because of the S-curve that goes down through River's Edge and White Oak. So that is actually a slower zone than if they're west of town or once they get over towards Oswego and it straightens out and they start going again. So that does have an effect. That's my understanding of talking with a couple of the railroad guys last summer about how they are supposed to do that. Now, I'm sure that there are people that can just truly lay on the horn all they want, and then those who just do that little toot...
A little toot, you don't...
...are probably violating
okay,
the regulations.
That's what I was wondering.
They're probably being courteous. Mm-hmm. But...
In the middle of the night.
Mm-hmm. And I can understand that, but there is also the potential that they are violating federal regulations, and that could be problematic on those engineers. So, Jackie?
While we have you here, maybe I don't know if you even can answer this. So say you go to a quiet zone, and God forbid there's an accident. What liability is in there that you made it? Like, what if someone comes back, well, that's because there was a quiet zone, we didn't hear it, and you know there was an accident. Is that liability placed on the city because we requested the quiet zone, or is
there's
it no?
Too many what ifs, and I think in that one, where is everything functioning properly? You know, there's a whole bunch of stuff that
I just don't. I don't want that to increase.
The quiet zone actually increases a lot of the safety factors, so you'd have to go through and see if they're all working properly.
Exactly.
So, are we responsible for that kind of stuff?
In general, the railroad would try to push all liability
on the city.
Since the requesting okay, more.
Since we are making it, heard. Basically how it would work is we're making a change to their system.
Mm-hmm. They don't care.
So, right, they don't care, but if we're requesting to make a change,
we pay
who's
for
the onus going to be on?
And we have all responsibilities.
Exactly. We maintain it. We are most likely going to take
responsibility. Sort of like what IDOT does with us.
Yeah. Obviously, just
very similar.
Very similar.
So, and of course... The railroad has a lot more power than does IDOT.
Oh my God.
So you think about that. We're going to have maintenance costs. We're going to pay for it. And we will probably take on liability, which would be a legal question for our attorneys and our insurer.
Our insurance.
As to what type of issues we would have there. So there's a lot to think about and consider. Obviously, this spent 9 months in committee. From 2014 to 2015, then went out to council, and now it's back. We've had this in here for a couple months. So this has definitely been given a lot of thought over the past few years. So at this point, I don't want the community to think that we are being dismissive of your concerns. We definitely do hear them. And at this point, I would ask the committee members how they feel about moving this forward to council. For a vote, or if at this point you would like to table discussion. Ken and Jackie?
You know, it's already been to council or went down, so I'm just.
Jackie, I think you're comfortable tabling.
Yeah, I just don't think we have the money for it.
I get table it unless there's a reason. It sounds like we can't afford it. Because I think that's what our last approach was, right? We figured at that time that...
That was the bulk of the discussion when it was out in front of council, is that due to the costs... You know, granted, the scope was the full phase 1, 2, and 3, or ABC, however you want to term it. But still, it was known that we wouldn't be able to discuss it. So, and I will weigh in as well that at this point, I don't think it is beneficial for us to move forward based on the fact that we would probably not be able to fund... the improvements necessary. So at this point, this item will be tabled and we'll stop here for now.
Can we, can we find out? I would like to know that too. Can we bring that back of what are the, it would be nice if people call her that, what are the regulations for?
Yeah. I have no problem
for the horns.
Keeping this on the docket for something we can discuss ongoing is are there changes in the regulations? Do we have. You know, do we see anything changing? And if we can get some additional information here or there, I don't have a problem with that. But I think for this proposal, for the study, I think it dies here for the moment. Okay. I appreciate you all coming out for that. I know it's not what you really wanted to hear. All right. With that one, we will continue on. Old business, Public Works 2016-21, the Apardo Energy update.
There's a brief memo in your packet. The RFP document is submitted. Wasn't something I felt we could approve outright. And so when talking to Dan Santo in Oswego, he had identified some potential partnerships on a couple of these projects, and we're in the middle of hiring our purchasing manager. We actually get interviews next week, so hopefully by March 1 we'll have somebody in place. And so he had already directed a couple of the consultants that he'd been talking to talk to the purchasing manager after they get on board, and he saw that that was a perfect program. So that's my recommendation. Rather than be spent time on it in the next couple months and then hand it over to them, I'd rather work together with Oswego and do it all at once. And then I noted a couple of the RFQ issues in there, just that, you know, I'd recommend that we draft our own. We'd go to the DCEO for some recommendations, and then actually make it more vague than it was drafted so that we have the potential for more projects. So, you know, rather than try to go through and get into the details on the projects now, I prefer to just leave it to a purchasing manager and expect them to manage it at some point in the future.
If you would go through some specifics on the benefit of the purchasing manager as compared to current staff managing this process for us.
Well, it's one person managing it for two towns. So theoretically, you've got the efficiencies there of just, you know, one person having to spend the time reviewing the process, talking to vendors who may be soliciting, you know, for business. And then also when it comes down to the actual projects after they start up, like with water meters, if we replace all the water meters in the city and go to like a tower read system, you might be able to install one antenna tower between Oswego and Yorkville rather than each community having to install two. So, you know, those are things that, you know, can save you tens of thousands of dollars when you do, if you decide to do together. So biofuel is another one that we talked about. You know, we've discussed fueling stations and some other things over the past year or two with Oswego and Montgomery. So if we move forward, like, with a water plant, or if we get a joint facility somewhere between them, between the three towns, you'd actually have one of them and have one performance contracting project that then staff wouldn't have to manage. So just from talking to Buffalo Grove, Glenview, and there was another one that it's escaping me now. You know, the process can be fairly intense, even though it's supposed to be turnkey. The act of doing the RFQs and reviewing them and then actually interfacing with the vendor can be something that takes up a fair amount of time and can be a fairly chaotic process. So, you know, I prefer not to do that myself if I've got a technical expert in purchasing that's going to be coming up more in the next month or two.
I've got a couple more.
Go ahead.
Jackie or Ken?
Go ahead, Chris.
Okay. Thinking through the projects that have been identified in the proposal as it is, several of those are not such that would easily be facilitated as a joint venture between another municipality. You know, if you look at what they are, how they could be done, you know, there are differences between systems. How could we incorporate those? For the benefit of Yorkville, and I always have to come back to the benefit of Yorkville first. You know, some projects, yes, they make sense to joint venture with our partners, in whether it's Kendall County, Montgomery, Oswego. Anyways, makes sense if we can do it. But there are certain items in here that I don't think are necessarily something we could do. One thing that I understand there's some language in here that you're not comfortable with, that legal's not comfortable with, that can always be changed. The biggest issue I'm going to have is I am trying to find ways to facilitate dealing with problems that we have had over the past several years and find a solution quickly. And I don't want to do it quickly out of haste. I want to do it quickly out of need for facilitating the problems. And that's where this comes about. Obviously, Bart, you've been working on some individual pieces for lighting. You've, you know, spoken with Siemens. You've spoken with some others on different pieces for water meters. None of that's been brought to committee for discussion. I know you've worked on that. You're not prepared or ready to bring it forward, you know, at the status that you're at.
this is an opportunity that came up, whether this is the right group or there's another group to do it. Feature center, fleet vehicles, water meters. You know, we're always looking for revenue. As much as we don't want to say we're trying to, you know, bring in more revenue because that sounds bad to the taxpayers, we have to be fair about how we're operating. Our fleet, we need to make certain that we're on top of that. We've had issues with it. Beecher, we have still yet to address Beecher. I've been here 5 years. We haven't addressed it as an issue before I came on. These are issues that are lagging. There's a proposal on the table to address it. And I understand that there are some concerns from staff. That I get. My issue is I want to see us starting to facilitate those issues, those concerns, and addressing them. And don't mean to offend staff, but staff hasn't been accommodating that yet. And I know things take time through government. Government is very, very slow, and unfortunately, I don't like going slow. But
on the shared component of it, I understand that there will be projects that we go along with Oswego. And with the purchasing manager, it's not that 100% of their time is going to be used on Oswego and Yorkville issues. It's generally just that we're splitting time.
Because right, we have time that person right. will do our projects for us.
Right.
And I know that's the hire of that person is not very far. So that's something that can happen.
Yep.
So that type of a delay is not a major concern for me because that's maybe that delays it 1 or 2, 3 months, you know, getting their feet wet, getting into the system. My concern is I don't want to leave on the table an opportunity for the city to address issues and concerns. Is this the right way to do it? I don't know. Are there some good ideas in there? I think so. It's just, this is something that I think we can look at. It obviously is a new proposal that's been brought to us. We haven't done this before. Obviously, you can take it piecemeal or you can take it as a whole. I don't have a problem if we want to retweak the scope on the RFQ. But one of the issues I will take with last month's meeting to this month is last month we did ask for some department head input. And I know it was your decision that you wanted to push this based on the fact of the marketing manager being brought in. However, that's one that this committee did ask for information. I would have appreciated and liked to have that information here for us to take into account what the other department heads have to say about the ideas in here. And
it would have been a waste of their time from last month to this month. If I felt reasonably that you would have tabled the item, I don't want to go through, force them to research an issue, discuss it, present it, knowing full well that it's going to come back in front of us in 2 months. So that's why I made the decision not to do it. I mean, we talked that this is going to be a relatively simple process, but, I mean, just the act of discussing and conversing and listening to presentations has already spent more of my time over the past 2 or 3 months than a lot of other projects that are a higher city council priority. And so that's what I'm getting at. In the scheme of things, it's a relatively new vehicle. I'm not sure that it's totally right for a lot of the projects, and I don't know that those decisions need to be discussed and
they should be.
And pushed forward immediately.
And I concur with you. They should.
And that's why, and I got nervous a little bit about when I read through here and I found that they submitted the language for the RFP. That shouldn't, I don't know how that can be done that way, but.
Well, we can adopt anything
right. And
that anybody submits. That's not an issue as long as we're comfortable with it. But I read it, and
this is in a month, right?
Things, yeah.
And it's specific language. We haven't drafted a program like this, but it's not to say that our attorney and staff can't draft something that is suitable for us. The RFP document is, you know, whether it's this form or a different form, completely different form altogether. My concern is I don't want to stop the process of exploring this opportunity. The program with the state is a good opportunity for us to fund programs, have an assurity that says the contractor is responsible for shortcomings of savings. And to me, that's a good win-win. It's a guarantee that if the programs don't work, we're not out money, the contractors. They have an obligation to perform and make certain that we realize those performance savings. And that, if that's something we can utilize, I would like to continue that discussion. I don't want to kill this. Now, like I said, language couldn't be done. Obviously, yes, it was submitted by the petitioner here, but this is an RFQ. It's a qualification based. It's not proposal based at this point. So,
just following up, I have two big concerns with this. That, again, they're not pregnant issues now, but based on what I'm hearing from other communities, vendor contact during the process with elected officials and other staff members, community leaders, has been an issue with other companies, not present company excluded, as far as I know. Multiple communities are saying this is a good process for you to guarantee savings on certain items, but on certain projects, you may just take the guaranteed savings from doing something like putting in the HVAC center, or HVAC at the Beecher Center, saving the money on maintenance. You don't necessarily need like the insurance guarantee that you're going to save money. So that's something that I'm concerned about. You know, just making sure that we draft it so that it's as clean as possible, and then moving forward. So based on those discussions and, you know, how we're reviewing this, it's new to us, and we've got somebody else that's dealing with it. I really just didn't want to spend a lot of time getting into the nitty-gritty of it before we were protected from any issues that could potentially arise from it. And that's been my concern from, you know, real-world feedback. So that's where I'm at. I see this as a potentially good project. I don't think that it's the right time, given, you know, the amount of effort that we've put into it and some other city projects that are going on.
Jackie, what are your thoughts?
I don't know.
It just seems rushed to me so far. I mean, we've seen the presentation last month, and if there's concerns, I think we ought to. And plus, has the whole rest of the council seen this?
They haven't yet, and they would really see it after a committee has endorsed it and seen the RFQ document. So that part of the process is fine, in that as long as four of you agree with it, and presumably staff is on board with the recommendation to proceed forward and the capabilities to execute it, then it would be fine to take it to City Council. I just, you know, I can go through and I can draft an RFQ document next month that's vague. It's going to take a lot of our time over the next month with Kathy, who's got some experience probably with projects, but not necessarily performance contracting, going through and vetting it, and then I've got a purchasing manager that's going to come on board hopefully in March 1. So I just looked at that and said it's probably an inefficient use of my time and everybody else on staff to go through, to learn about it, to put forth the effort when we've got other things going on, and then to have a purchasing manager who may have already done this in another municipality or a different state and have some familiarity with it.
And if you recall, last month I had asked, do we want to take this out to, you know, I asked as far as we're going to, do we take it out to a discussion at council for everyone to discuss this issue? Right,
yeah.
And you know, and I know you didn't think that was the right time to take it out there and discuss it that way, but that was kind of my thought, is do we take it out there? Do we talk over this? These are some large, overreaching topics that we're looking at here. I mean, they're not small items. They are big-picture budget items, and it's somewhat of a shift of process. So I'm not trying to rush it. I know last month we asked for information back from department heads. We're trying to vet this and figure this out. This is obviously a new program. We're following up on the heels of Kendall County going through a similar process. I did speak with the state's attorney about the RFP. They did review it. And in terms of comments, there were a couple, but they were there's nothing that they had that was holding it up at the point, but they did, as a committee, stop it because of an election issue. So theirs is actually now behind where we are.
Mm-hmm.
We just jumped ahead because theirs is on hold, but Eric really didn't have anything to say about the agreement other than, yeah, it had been reviewed in their office and it had been moved out into their committee. So, I do want to continue with the discussion of this one. I don't want it to feel rushed. I'd like to, you know, if we can incorporate the marketing manager on working this through, as long as it is in our favor and it's meeting our objectives, I don't want to lose sight of opportunity to facilitate anything for Oswego. I know that sounds bad, but...
Yeah. So, I just, where you're coming from, Chris, so basically, Bart, you're just saying let's hold on to it until this person comes in.
March 1st.
But you would like to move... I guess I'm not...
Well, I was hoping we would get, you know, a little department head on the issues, the items that are in here, to continue that discussion. That's what I was wanting to do, is continue the discussion. Obviously, we don't have to approve an RFP. We can obviously... I'm sure you could have one drafted, and then by the time the marketing manager comes in, that person is able to review it and fine-tune it, or we wait till March. You said March is when the start is?
Interviews are end of January, so depending on the selection process and then the actual start date, it could be March 1,
around
could be end of March.
And so, you know, you figure that if then,
what's the worst that we wait? I mean, what's your fear that we wait till March?
Yeah, that's what I don't get.
If we wait till March, you know, depending on...
If their study's legit...
Well, depending on the workload, when does it come back to us? The only reason I'm, you know, saying let's keep this discussion going is we've seen items, you know, we discuss them, then they go back at staff level, they will not come back for 6, 8, 10 months. That's my concern. Okay? I don't want this to take 2 years to go through the process and figure out if it's something we can do. I just want to continue to move her. And so, if it's March, as long as this person knows, yeah, we want to consider it. I mean, this has potential for policy decisions for us. We're about to come through a budget discussion. This has potential impact on budget discussions. That's kind of what I'm looking at, is there are factors in here that could change how we decide make decisions moving forward. So, you know, if we get into March and then we're discussing RFPs April, May, then it's obviously not going to be something that could be incorporated for fiscal year. We're out another year, which is fine. But I just want to kind of get the big picture items out there for discussion. That's what I was thinking. Do we talk about it overall, you know, with the council?
I don't think
marketing manager.
I'm not saying we kill it, but I think you should give staff in the March 1st. I don't think that's asking too much.
So if the person's brought in March, what would be a realistic expectation of seeing a draft RFP with department head input?
I don't know until the person comes on board and I get a chance to talk to them and know what their capabilities are. If they start March 1st, to me it would be reasonable to have a draft done as like a first project for the March Public Works Committee meeting, but I can't make the...
But that's it. I'm just hypothetical. I'm not, not going to commit you to anything, but best case scenario, March 1st, and then, you know, that's 3 weeks, obviously, to...
At minimum, at March Public Works Committee meeting, I can give a status update as to where the purchasing manager is in the process, if they're hired, and kind of what they think about it.
Because from the study, we decided there are some things that... There are some things that are good for us, and then there are some things that really...
There are some things that I'm skeptical about, okay? But my sole high-level review of it don't necessarily weigh into the process, because... The process is vague in that you should ask for a performance contracting vendor. You pick one, and then you negotiate individual projects with that vendor. That's what we've heard is the benefit.
The proposal we have is these are items that are we see as something that could be done for you.
Yeah.
Once you go through qualifications, you pick that person, and then you pick the projects. This is where we're at right now is nowhere near selecting. I mean, it could be 180 degrees from where we're at with the assessment that they've done on the SIP.
Exactly. So, I mean, perfect example is biofuel. Mm-hmm. I think I'm skeptical, and from what I've talked to Eric and Rich, you know, there could be some issues with it from over here from other people. But if we pick a vendor, and the vendor is well-versed in it and says, no, here's the financials, here's how it works, It's not an issue. You can talk to 10 other municipalities that I'm aware of. And we can say, oh, okay, great, we're going to go do that project at some point or another. So, you know, I think I misunderstood the process a little bit at the beginning because I was new to it, you know, and saying like, oh, you know, we shouldn't even discuss this. We should look into it. And the process could be more open-ended on the front end. And so that's, you know, that's not necessarily an issue, like, going forward as much as it is. You know, there will be a time later after we choose a vendor to decide which projects we want to embark on.
And we have no clue, like, to what this will cost us, because we don't know what projects, really.
So the cost is basically all baked into the system. So it's all, you know, there are, you know, consultant fees and stuff that theoretically get paid, but it's all basically just, you want the Beecher Center HVAC system replaced? Yes, great, they go do it, and then you work out the financial mechanism.
So in that case right there, though, you're saying we would be committing to actually doing that project.
Yeah, then you work out right. You work it out on a project by project.
Basically, what you do.
Right, now, do we know we have the money to even do that project?
No. Here, so basically, if you have five projects that are itemized, that okay, these sound good. Let's get proposals. We get the proposals. We say we want to go on three of the projects. Those projects are going to cost you $1 million to do. You're not putting a capital outlay for $1 million. That cost is coming from the savings. So it's basically doing a bond without going to a tax roll. It's the savings of the projects are what are funding the project.
It just seems weird, though. It's weird
because it came from the Illinois State Legislature.
Well, there we go. Should we really
but,
be yeah. doing
it's basically, But it's basically taking whatever savings you have and allowing you to finance your program. And yes, there are fees that go to consultants.
Collateral is like your savings.
Yeah.
You're banking on your savings.
But our general fund's not at risk. The tax rolls are not going to be touched by it. It's nothing that goes.
So,
what if your savings didn't work out like you think?
That's where the guarantee comes in. The guarantee comes from the contractor.
So.
And is that guarantee? How strong is that guarantee?
It has to be ironclad, backed by the state.
So. Say, like, right now, Beecher costs you $100,000. And then they go ahead and you put in your equipment, and it's going to bring it down. It's only $50,000 to run it. You're saying that savings, that other $50,000 that's in the budget, or, like, say, for cost.
So it costs you $40 to replace the unit up there, and you're paying $20 per month in power.
Right, okay. So that goes back to your...
Instead of paying the $40 to put in the unit, it's free to us, but we keep paying $20 a month in power consumption each month, even though maybe the actual cost of power consumption is $5. And depending on the project...
And then how that builds up for your project.
It can be maintenance costs, it can be a whole lot of other things. So, but that's like the general gist of like the most simple form of the project is energy costs.
Yeah, so. I mean, the streetlights are the prime example on that one there. It's the streetlights, you know, granted we're not paying, but we're the labor of having somebody go out replacing bulbs, replacing ballast on a regular basis. We go through that a lot, don't we, here? Mm-hmm.
So another good example, too, would be water meters. Mm-hmm. Older water meters don't register as often,
so you replace them, you get the revenue.
So Glenview went through the due diligence of this process, and they said, we know our water meters are old. Why would we pay somebody to give us an insurance, you know, guarantee that we're going to make money? We know that they're old, that they're going to make money. We're just going to take on all of the risk, all of the project management, all the costs to ourselves. And theoretically have a little bit of extra money at the end of the day. So they're large enough that they thought that was a good idea. So something like the Beecher Center, you know,
we
after
could just
a consultant
go do,
looks
we could
at,
put it in our budget and do it ourselves.
Yes, you could.
But we haven't done it for 5 years.
Wow.
You know, and like the water meters, yes. Could we, as a city, pay for every water meter?
So in all technique.
It's a financing mechanism, basically.
Right, it's a financing mechanism with a security, That doesn't go on the tax rolls. So that's... really what it comes down to is it's an alternative method of financing projects.
This is strange.
Yeah, it is strange.
Bring it back for more information or continue discussion later?
I mean, we could go with what Bart suggested.
March 1st.
And table it until we get this person in and...
update the committee?
March committee?
And that's what I'd heard.
What's our date in March?
21st.
March 21st, thank you. It's
like I see where...
I can't imagine others aren't going to have some questions about it, too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, is there a way in between?
The questions really should be asked when you get into the RFQ process. You're picking a vendor that you want to work with, theoretically, for all these other projects, and then on a project-by-project basis, or an agreement-by-agreement basis. So you can lump building improvements and a water meter project and streetlights all into one like agreement after you choose a vendor. And so that's really like the time for City Council to look at it and say, do we want to work with this company? Okay, yes. And then do we want to do this project? Okay, yes. And then go.
Could we have the presentation we had here go to the full council? Just the presentation?
Yes.
Because we're kind of skipping that, aren't we? If we bring in the RFQ.
You can. Honestly, I don't find it useful. I don't think that you need...
Or at least a copy of the study should be in your hands.
Until you get to the point where you're ready to choose a vendor and you're going project by project.
With that one,
I guess I'm thinking that would explain why we're going to this.
Right, and
I feel like we're missing
the stage. That's what I was just going to say, is if we take just the RFP, people are going to have questions. What is the process? How is this process different than our standard? So maybe the presentation would not be a bad thing in order to do it. But I mean, that's...
Can I jump in for a second? The only thing I will say is in the statute, it does require council approval to issue the RFP process or RFQ. So... However you guys decide that does actually have to go to council before you actually get any proposals back for them to make a decision on what gets implemented.
I guess why I'm saying...
Typically, that's where it goes, the next step.
But there's only, four of us that saw... One's not here.
Right.
He's gone.
Right.
That saw that.
Only three of us.
So there's three of us that have seen your presentation. Mm-hmm. And then we're going to... To me, it's like we're skipping a step.
And we're just taking them the proposal...
Just to give you an example of what the county did, it started out in the Public Safety Committee because it first started out. Then it went to Finance, and then they said, let's go to the County Board, and the County Board agreed to start the study, and then it was brought back to County Board, and we're actually going there the 31st for them to make a decision to approve the RFQ process because they had new members coming on in that interim, and they didn't want one board being attached to something with new board members coming on.
They moved it between two of their committees.
Typically, the process is it does go before the executive body or legislative body before issuing an RFQ or RFP, just because the statute requires that. Unless your home rule, some of the communities that he referenced, Buffalo Grove, Glenview, those communities, were all home rule communities, and those were all consortium done. Specifically on a water meter project, they weren't anything else. It was just strictly water meters.
I feel like that if I brought the RFQ in front of you, that I would be able to explain it enough in writing and memo ahead of time that you would be able to understand and adopt at least the process going forward. Given that, yes, you are required to vote on the RFQ document, but it doesn't commit you to doing anything beyond that. You could review all the bids, and then we can say, no thanks. Or, yes, we're going to pick one and then move forward with the individual project. So, if everybody's like, hey, I want to listen to a 45-minute presentation again, that's fine. But I feel like I go through the entire budget of $30 million. I give you the memo ahead of time. You know, I'm able to explain that over, the course of an hour. I don't know that this warrants that much.
We've had the water study. Some of us sat through that multiple times an hour.
It would especially be the RFQ.
Fun study.
But, I mean, it's a different process.
I love the water study.
Not disparaging the water study. But 3 hours, actually about 3 hours, 45 minutes total.
I heard it more than you, so
I'm sure
I hear you.
I can recite it.
Dream about it.
Well, maybe it is something to consider taking to council for a discussion. I mean, you did mention, Bart, that you kind of misinterpreted this program initially. We've had a few memos, and I know there's still questions about it. So maybe it is something that it would be beneficial to have others chime in and hear it. And I understand, it's going to take some time.
We're waiting for the new purchasing director.
Right. So maybe, sometime between now and February, it goes for council discussion or presentation and Q&A, and then comes back.
So the actual study that we got, the actual study booklet, never went to other council members?
No. It was not distributed, no. It was put in the packet, but it was not disseminated
I know, like, you had asked for the downtown study to be sent out to everybody.
Right.
Specifically, it wasn't sent out, I don't recall.
The, from the city council meeting? Or from the EDC meeting?
From where?
No.
No, from here.
He's talking about from
our
the public
that
works.
We received.
The part.
We had the actual study that they did. They presented in December. We yeah, didn't. Did that
no,
go
no,
down?
No.
No, he's just using it as a
comparison. I was using. Ken's asking, did the study that Leah Parto do
in December
directly distributed to the council?
Okay.
And I said no. And
so there wasn't one put in everybody's mailbox?
No.
Okay. I'll verify.
Yeah, verify that one. That's not a problem. So moving forward, two options, I guess kind of three. Table till March here.
Yeah.
Take it to council for discussion, or presentation discussion, or wait for presentation until after we have marketing manager.
Well, the March thing, will, odds are that will be with the marketing manager, right?
Right. So do we just wait on everything until then, or in the interim, do we take it to council for a presentation at some point in the next?
That, or at least get the study told to everybody.
Yeah, if you don't want to do the presentation, make sure everything
does it. At least make sure they have it in their
would
hands
be,
to look through it. And
yeah. I know our presentation was, what, 40 minutes, 45 minutes?
Yeah, about 45.
It'll be done in 2025. A somewhat abridged, but detailed enough to give them what they need and then ask questions. Would that be? I mean, between now and March, there's several meetings we have that we could get that onto an agenda, and if others have questions, they could be posed. Because, you know, the downtown study is an easy one to distribute and say, hey, this is what the proposal was. If they get this study, what's the purpose of it?
That is a lot of stuff in it.
Yeah, what's the purpose of them receiving it? Maybe the presentation kind of gives them a little help with it.
I'm more of a visual learner, so I would like a presentation. So I'll put it to
I'm okay with either way.
Okay.
I'd rather do that than read through all that.
So, direction moving forward.
Table
can we
March,
condense it a little bit?
March update. And then somewhere between now and then, Bart will find a place in a council agenda for a presentation and coordinate to be a part of that.
So what are we doing about the... Are you going to write a separate RFQ?
I think
for March,
it would be my recommendation to have the purchasing manager
do that
process.
Okay.
Yes.
Today, if not, they'll be tomorrow.
Okay, because yep. I noticed that, and I was like, wow, a week it lasted. And
it's all about it. Sometimes it does.
Mm-hmm. And I hope that not as we go further along, we can maybe continue that discussion about maybe splitting Walsh
mm-hmm.
up in the
right,
north side.
Like
versus,
we said,
yeah,
right. First Walsh versus Greenbrier. Yep.
Yeah, especially if you're going to be turning barberries.
Yes.
Yep. If it's possible to get that, at least get it on the list. I know it's years down the road, but.
Yep. Absolutely, and I believe...
Because I don't know how it's going to last that long.
I'm with you.
Yeah.
It seems to fall apart quicker every year, along with East and West Barberry.
Right. And those intersections even are really bad. So.
I hear you. I'm with you on that. And I also think, just on that note, since I believe if the parts came in, we should have the 400-watt bulb.
Yes, yeah, I've seen that. You know.
Okay.
Yep. Great. So, go ahead.
Jackie?
Good.
Nothing from Jackie? I have nothing.
we'll adjourn at 7:43.
Thank you.